Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. Today's episode will be the second part of our two-part commemoration of Yom HaShoah, or Holocaust Remembrance Day. In our previous episode, my friend Michael Adams and I discussed Claude Lanzmann's 1985 documentary, Shoah. This time, I'm going to discuss another Holocaust documentary, though it's got a decidedly different focus, where Shoah spends 9.5 hours recounting the numerous atrocities committed under the Nazi regime. Today's film, Weapons of the Spirit, instead shines a light on a group of individuals who acted heroically under the most harrowing of circumstances. This film is about a French village called La Chambon, where between 1940 and 1944, the community banded together to save approximately 5,000 Jews from imprisonment and deportation by the Nazi-controlled Vichy government. I'm very pleased to announce that today's special guest is the director of Weapons of the Spirit, Pierre Sauvage. Welcome, Pierre.
Thank you.
Can you give us a brief synopsis of the film beyond what I just gave, and tell us how this project came about?
Well, your synopsis was pretty good. Yes, this tiny mountain community, the village, and it should be added, the surrounding area, did indeed band together and shelter, by one estimate, which I accept, about 5,000 Jews, not at one time, incidentally. You know, this also became a turning point for people being brought elsewhere. And so it's just over the course of the 4 years, that many people may have been sheltered. Well, the starting point for me was the fact that I had the good fortune to be born in that village at that time to parents who had found shelter there. So for me, it was in a way the ultimate ego trip, reconstructing the circumstances of one's birth. But when I visited there with my wife many decades ago, I realized that this was a story that should be told. It had not yet been told in any documentary. And I wanted to capture these people, the rescuers and the rescued, before they disappeared. Most of them have since gone on. So that was really the genesis of the film.
Yeah, and it was originally released 25 years ago, correct?
That's correct. It was released in 1989, so we're now in the 25th anniversary year, and I've in fact been tweaking like mad because I had gotten to the point where, even though candidly it was a successful film, it was very well received, it got a lot of very, very good reviews, I had gotten to the point where all I could see were the glitches, all I could see were the things that were bad and that could be fixed. So I've just spent a lot of time, too much time, according to my family, fixing those things. And I'll be releasing this new remastered. Also, a lot of the pictures were redone. A lot of stuff that could be done in the digital age that couldn't be done then. The film had been edited in 16 millimeter, which felt to me a little bit like driving a truck. You know, if you aim to where you want to go, and if you get close, you're happy.
And now we can be more precise. Yeah. But the larger themes of the film still remain largely the same, right?
Oh, the film is not changed in any fundamental way. There are two new elements in the film, but even those are not that important. I think what's interesting is that the context for the film has changed. When the film came out in 1989, rescue was not a popular subject. It was a pretty obscure subject too. And since we're honoring Yom HaShoah, I'll mention also that it was not popular with Holocaust survivors. Holocaust survivors were concerned that the world would use the rescuers as an alibi, that they would say, "See, things weren't so bad." You know, I was convinced that the opposite was true. That in fact, every rescuer is an act of accusation.
What do you explain what you mean by every rescue is an act of accusation?
Well, I think what makes rescuers particularly interesting is the fact that they are the people that we should be measuring ourselves against. We shouldn't be measuring ourselves against the Nazis. We're unlikely to even to want to commit such atrocities, let alone be capable of it. So, of course, we compare ourselves to evil, we come out great. we have to compare ourselves to people who are apathetic in the face of avoidable catastrophes. And that is the majority of people. So the way to do that is to have a standard of comparison. So yes, they hold us accountable in a way that the bad guys don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mentioned last episode we talked about Shoah, and in that film it was story after story of people who stood by and watched and did nothing. And in this film, it's about a group of people who took a stand and decided that they weren't going to allow the government to murder the Jews. Where do you think these people got their moral certainty and the courage?
Well, the film over an hour and a half tries to unpack that sort of and try to unravel what the motivations were. And I think they were varied. Certainly, for those who don't know the story at all, I should mention that the rescuers in question in that tiny area of France were the descendants of the Huguenots, the first Protestants in Catholic France. And they themselves had a history of being persecuted. And persecuted people tend to have affinities for each other. But in addition, they were Christians who had a particular slant on their faith, both in terms of the importance that they attached to the Old Testament, so particular feelings about the Jews, who were, after all, the people of the Old Testament, and also in terms of their understanding of Christianity, that to them, what mattered is what you did, not what you said. You know, I think that's at the heart of what happened. I want to hasten to add that by no means do I believe, in fact, I'm convinced that this is not remotely the case, that Protestants by and large acted better than Catholics. In fact, Catholics in occupied Europe were often particularly remarkable because they had poor leadership. So they really had to act on their own. So there's a lot to be said on that subject. But
the film actually reminded me of Au Revoir, l'Enfant.
Mm-hmm.
Where in that the Louis Malle film, mm-hmm. the takes place at a boys' Catholic school, and in that film the minister attempts to rescue three Jewish boys, and I don't want to spoil the film, but
Au Revoir les Enfants is a wonderful film.
Yeah,
and I knew Louis Malle slightly, and he saw Weapons of the Spirit, and we compared notes, and he had interesting attitudes towards the whole Jewish issue and all that. Of course, he wasn't Jewish.
Yeah. To have such uniformity within this small community is a remarkable thing. How were there, I mean, I know in the film you mentioned that there may have been one or two people who they called, collaborators, yes. But aside from that, even they didn't cause a lot of trouble. How did they get everyone to play along?
Well, the answer is, in a way, that they it couldn't have happened if it wasn't embedded in the individuals themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You can't create that type of movement. My favorite line in the whole film, I think, I have a few lines that I like, I will admit, but one of my absolute favorite lines is the widow of the pastor who says, people always ask me, what was your organization? Well, if we'd had an organization, we would have failed.
Right.
And what she means by that is that this is something that has to be essentially spontaneous in order to work. Then what you can do is you can orient it and you can channel it. But, you know, the villagers, Le Chambon probably would not, the people of Le Chambon might have had the inclination to do what they did, but they might not have understood the need to do it if it hadn't been that the pastor and the assistant pastor were clear on this and were explaining it to them. And also they played a large role in bringing Jews to Le Chambon because they had contacts with organizations and, you know, these organizations that were involved in rescue. And these organizations came to know Le Chambon was a good place to send your Jews.
Mm-hmm. As I was watching the film, I tried to imagine what I would do were I in their place. And I think it's easier to do the right thing if you're given permission to do the right thing and if you're given instructions on how to do the right thing. So was it these two pastors who sort of paved the way for these people to figure out how they could help?
I think it was really a confluence. It was a confluence of both the nature of this population that was inclined to help. And I think related to your question, I think there were a few people in the story who were ostensibly bad guys. The Vichy police sent a spy to live and work in the village. There was a Vichy official who was responsible for that area of France. And these people were both ostensibly bad. And the more I researched the issue, the more I realized, yeah, but they didn't really do anything bad. And one of the conclusions I drew from it is that people get sucked into things. Just like you can get sucked into evil, you can get sucked into good.
Yeah.
And that's part of our responsibility to try to generate a little bit of good where we can, because other people may join in. And that's the guidance that you were talking about, too.
Right, right. One of the villains of the film is the Vichy youth minister. Maybe you can help me with the pronunciation.
Yes, Lamiran.
Lamiran.
Yes.
Did I do that right?
Yes, that's very good.
You got an interview with him. And while the film is largely about heroes, this is the one character in the film that you speak to who doesn't come out looking all that great.
Right. Definitely not a hero.
Yeah. Talk to me about that interview.
It's a really interesting interview, I think. In terms of the role that I make it play and that it plays in the film. It's also, you know, it's funny that Lamiran accepted to talk to me. I mean, he had been a minister of Vichy. He knew I was making a documentary on Le Chambon. I didn't ambush him in that sense. But he didn't. He agreed to be interviewed, I think, for several reasons, and I think they're interesting. One will interest you as the film scholar you are. And that is that he had accepted to be interviewed by Marcelo Fuchs for that great film, The Sorrow and the Pity. And he had come out well in The Sorrow and the Pity.
Okay.
So he thought, well, you know, and The Sorrow and the Pity was such a controversial film, very challenging of French, phony French beliefs about what had happened during the war. If I came out well from The Sorrow and the Pity, what do I have to fear from this film? That was one reason. The second reason is more profound. I'm not sure if viewers understand it this way, but I'm convinced it's the case. I think he had nothing on his conscience. I think he didn't understand that just having served as part of that government that deported Jews, that identified them, that persecuted them, and that helped to get them deported was a responsibility, even if he personally was not in any way directly involved in that crime. And he didn't understand that. I hope that that's part of what comes through. I think one of my other favorite lines in the film, actually, I'm hesitating because I'm suddenly realizing that remark too is sort of a shrug, and shrugs play a very important role in the film. You know, at the beginning of the film, I interview this old couple that are sort of the key rescuers in the film, and they happen to, one learns at the end of the film that they happen to have helped my parents as well. And when I press the woman as to why they kept sheltering Jews, even if it was, you know, even when it became dangerous, she sort of shrugs her shoulders and says, well, we were used to it. And it took me a long time when I was editing that film to realize that this was a key moment and to realize that that shrug and that refusal to elaborate on the answer was central to an understanding of who this person was. Well, the line that I was going to cite from Lamiran was when I point out that I'm talking about collaborators, you know, people in the government of which he was a part who help turn over Jews and talk about, refer to colleagues of his. And he corrects me to say, well, these were not, you know, I did no such action. I'm saying, I'm not accusing you of that. I'm saying the government of which you were part. And he says, oh, that. And that's another shrug. It's the exact counterpoint of the good shrug, you know.
Yeah.
So, no, I think one last comment on La Mirande, because it sort of amuses me is, well, I've said this before, but if I'd been able to find Hitler still around somewhere hiding in Peoria, I would have been thrilled to have the scoop. But he would not have been the right villain for me, because this was not about commission. This was and its opposite. It was about omission and its opposite. It was about apathy. And the Lamiral really was my perfect villain. Although, again, I don't believe he was a murderer. I just believe he was somebody who didn't even understand that being part of a murderous regime entails responsibility.
Right, right. You are complicit in some ways.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about the production process.
Right.
Did you know what you were going to say from the outset, or did the story kind of come together as you were editing?
It actually, the film came together in an unusual way for documentary filmmakers. As you know, we usually struggle for a long time to raise the funding and to get the project together, and we know it backwards and forwards by the time we actually shoot it, because we've been preparing it for so long. That's not what happened in this case. I actually had mentioned I had been to the village. I mentioned to a friend of mine that I thought this would make a great documentary. He happened to have a connection at French television. He mentioned it to this connection at French television. Within a few weeks, I found myself in Le Chambon with a crew filming this film, doing these interviews. And I did not have a clue what I was doing. I didn't have any understanding of these people. And this is a film that really was put together in the editing process, just watching the footage over and over and over again, realizing that sometimes it wasn't the emphatic statements that are important, but the more casual statements that really reveal more of what people really believe. Mm-hmm. I also came to realize, how important. I sort of knew this, but I didn't really know this. I might have had the tendency otherwise that a lot of documentary filmmakers have of covering up the talking heads. You know, we live in an era where people hate talking heads. Well, I love talking heads. I love seeing. I remember there was a documentary made decades ago called The Word Is Out about the birth of the gay revolution. And it was all talking heads beginning to end. And I thought it was just masterful. You know, I think there's nothing more fascinating. If you know enough, this is our responsibility as documentary filmmakers, if you're using talking heads, is to identify those moments when the people are really compelling, where they're authentic, where they're not posturing.
Right.
You know, you have to do that. If to see a talking head posture, if a talking head can't posture, is painful. But when people reek of authenticity, so that was my job, to try to make a film where people would feel they believed absolutely in the reality of these people. Even though I hasten to add, and I'm opening a lot of parentheses here, but people sometimes think that a documentary is the truth, which is nonsense. A documentary is not the truth. At best, it is the filmmaker's truth.
Right.
At best, the filmmaker is being sincere and believes it. But it is I put together the portraits of these people. I define them in a certain way.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, so much of a textbook is historical fiction. Anytime you have to turn history into some kind of linear story, so much is going to get, you have to kind of pick and choose what you're going to talk about. But in your case, I think the use of the talking heads is really effective, because most of them are set, most of the interviews are set in their homes. So it feels very natural, and you really get a sense of who they are, not just in the medium shots of the people, but you do get a sense of the surroundings as well.
So I'm glad you mentioned that, Pauline, because I'm going to mention something I've never mentioned publicly because it's so seems so trivial. But I really, there are moments in the film that I enjoy simply because they indicate the comfort level of the interviewees. And I'm sort of proud of that. I mean, it was part of my job to make them comfortable. So like there's an interview with two people and the woman is knitting. And a friend of mine said to me, how could she keep knitting while there's a camera in front of her? You know, I mean, people are usually nervous, you know, being interviewed. And she just continues casually her knitting. There's another, as it happens, it's also another couple. And the guy, they're having tea. And the guy in the middle of the interview bends forward and takes a cup of tea. And you hear the tea on the table. I couldn't be more delighted, you know, to hear the sound of that teacup.
Yeah.
Because it gives a feeling of reality.
Right. Yeah. I was wondering if you actually gave her the knitting needles intentionally.
I wish I'd had the astuteness to be able, I wish some of my other characters had been doing something, you know, that would also. I just want to add to what you said earlier, because it's so important that, you know, we live in an age where the written word is, people are skeptical of it. There is great wariness of what you read. But there's great belief in what you see. You know, somehow if you see it, it's true. And documentaries, to elaborate a little bit on what you said also, there's so little, there are no parentheses in documentaries. There are no footnotes. So you can get some, people can get things wrong in a documentary because they didn't mean necessarily to get it wrong, but because in telling the story, they really couldn't fit it in and they had to leave something out. Well, it may be that what they left out is really fundamental, and without it, the story is really not accurate. And that's what you have to be wary of.
How did you try and combat that?
Oh, just by going over everything over and over and over again. There are one or two moments when I wish I could have a little asterisk and elaborate a little bit on one thing. But it mattered a lot to me that the film be validated both by historians, which it has been.
Mm-hmm.
Most important to me, of course, was to have the validation of the people themselves. You know, when you're telling somebody's story, it's never exactly what they experienced. It'd be ridiculous to think anybody can in a film capture exactly, you know. And I always said I'd be perfectly happy if people just said it was more or less, you know, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
What they experienced.
Yeah. You're sort of serving two masters. You want to portray history somewhat accurately, but there are also time constraints, and you want to make sure everything is clear. So I think that's probably the biggest challenge, I'd imagine, is making sure that you're serving information that is digestible, but at the same time accurate.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And this was a very difficult film to put together because the film had to, not only did it have to be as intelligible as possible, as clear as possible, but in order for that to happen, it also had to move forward on several levels at once. And that had to work. It had to work. I am telling a story, so it had to work chronologically. But I'm also unraveling the religious beliefs of these people. So the explanations had to build, even though the story is going chronologically, the unpacking, to use that word again, of the religious dimension had to unfold as well. And then there were all the other levels, the psychological, the level of Vichy France, all these things had to move forward continuously. Without getting boring, the biggest risk, I it's nice to do a mea culpa once in a while. And, you know, there's one moment in the film, towards the end of the film, where I feel that probably I bring up the last rescuer that I bring up in the film, and I probably feel at that point when he shows up that there may be people who say, okay, I got it. You know, I don't really need him as well. And damn it. I adored that man. He was important. And I was, you know, going to put him in. There are times when the filmmaker places his own desire to tell the story in his way above what the audience, I mean, the audience, it's a crucial accountability, but it's not the sole accountability.
Yeah. Well, you make it clear from the beginning that this is, in some ways, your story as well. How much of yourself did you want to put in? How autobiographical did you want to make it?
Well, I come from a sort of a journalistic background, so I just come out of working at PBS, where I was doing news and public affairs documentaries, and also my own personal history was complicated. My parents' history was complicated. My parents really didn't really want this film to be made, so it was hard to navigate through those shoals. So I don't know whether what I ended up doing. I don't really know even to this day how well it works. I know that it was all I could do, which is basically to start the film by acknowledging my personal connection, because I think people want to know that, and you don't want to spring it on them at the end. It would be bizarre. But then I disappear, except I do the narration. So I'm still holding the viewer's hand, so to speak, throughout the film, but in a fairly neutral way. There's no I in the narration, except when it's... when I'm really talking about me, right, and my family. And then at the end, I reappear and I finish the story. Oh, people have sometimes said to me that the film, they would have enjoyed knowing more of the personal story. People have certainly complained to me that, how come you didn't interview your parents? Well, I couldn't interview my parents because my parents would never have given me the interview. Mm. But nor do I say it. But if I had said it, well, it would have been sort of like, who cares, you know?
Yeah.
Either you do it or you don't. But, you know, you work within the limitations you have.
Did your parents ever see the film, the finished film?
My parents saw the film. My father saw the film shortly before he died. Maybe it's appropriate to mention it's not in the film. But my parents were people who had chosen to put all this behind them to the point of hiding the fact that they were Jewish, so that I did not even learn that I was Jewish till I was 18. So that the film was not the work of a dutiful child fulfilling his parents' fondest wishes. It was the work of a rebellious child trying to reconnect with a part of history that he was deprived of. Well, with that context, you can imagine that it must have been very difficult for my father to hear the very first words of the film, which is, I am a European, you know, I forget the word, I'm a European-born Jew, born during the Nazi occupation, or something like that. But, you know, I identify right at the beginning, identifying myself as a Jew.
Yeah.
But I must say my parents never found fault with the basic premise. They knew that the people of Le Chambon had been a very special population. Mm. They had experienced them that way.
Did they ever go back to Le Chambon, ever?
They went back with me when I was a kid. I think I was a teenager. We went back, and we visited the old couple that are sort of symbolic in the film. So they had a certain, you know, attachment to the area, you know, but they again put Le Chambon behind them, and they put that whole experience behind them. And that was, by the way, in a way that's somewhat symbolic of the difficulty Jews had acknowledging the rescuers. And at the end of Weapons of the Spirit, I have this Polish Jew says, I have something important to say to the rescuers. And that is to acknowledge that he forgot Le Chambon because he had to emerge from the nightmare that he had experienced. But again, I'm working on a documentary on the Varian Fry rescue mission. Varian Fry was a New York intellectual who went to France after France fell to the Nazis, and with other Americans and others ended up helping to save some 2,000 people, many of them prominent. Remarkable story. very few people have ever heard of Varian Fry in America.
Mm-hmm.
And that is because, again, as we, you know, every rescuer raises question, knowing what the Varian Fry mission did is realizing what could have been done. This was at a time when America's doors were closed. Rescue is really important.
Absolutely, yeah.
You mentioned Shoah, and I know you have a parallel program on Shoah, which is, of course, a great and important film. You know, thank God it was made, because it really is a film that will last forever, mm-hmm. and provide essential testimony. Having said that, two things are limitations in the film. One, there is nothing about France, which is a may seem like a minor limitation, but when you're French, you should deal with your own, you know, a bit, even to the point of not interviewing any French survivors
right.
in the camps. And, you know, it's a film that the French could see without any discomfort whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing, which is a bit letting your own countrymen off a little bit easy, while poking your finger violently into the eye of the Poles,
Yes. When
the reality there was that there were also some remarkable Polish rescuers.
Absolutely.
Who, unlike the people of Le Chambon, who had the strength of a community behind them, were often acting alone, defying not only a much more challenging German occupation than what we had in France, but were also defying often their neighbors.
Right.
And that people, you know, went out to do this. So that's part of the story, too.
Yeah. Claude Lanzmann has said that the Holocaust could not have happened in France.
Did he really say that?
He said that. Yeah.
Well, the Holocaust did happen in France,
yeah.
of course. So it's nonsensical. There were not death camps in France.
Right.
So
that's probably what he meant.
Could there have been death camps in France? Interesting question. You know, I don't know that that's a question that's ever been proved to a great extent, but certainly. I made another film called "We Were There: Christians in the Holocaust," which part of it is interviews with three remarkable rescuers, and one of them points out that the French internment camps where Jews were dumped were within miles of major cities, and people would go by on the roads and on the trains, and nobody would try to find out what was happening in them. Murders weren't happening in them, but people were sometimes starving, and conditions were appalling. This is not a time on which anybody should take comfort in feeling, oh, we won the war, thank God we did, or we didn't have death camps on our soil. But this is a time when, except for those few rescuers who really salvaged our capacity to believe in the future, to realize that when we can always act well, even under the most challenging circumstance, except for those people, the world does not come out good.
Right. Yeah. Another thing Claude Lanzmann has said is that if he ever found archival footage of a death camp, he would burn it. And obviously Shoah has no archival footage. But your film makes lots of use of archival footage. So I assume you have no qualms about using historical footage.
No, I must say, Shoah's premise was obviously different from that of Weapons of the Spirit, so I sort of understand. He was playing with memory in a different way than I. I don't play with memory, actually. I really simply try to feed memory. So I had no qualms about using tons of photographs. It's a little bit like what I was saying earlier about faces, you know. Also, when you see, you know, look at the expressions on people's faces from then in photographs, it tells you a lot. And then there is extraordinary Vichy archival footage. I mean, those newsreels from that time are extraordinary. So no, I think it helps to bring home the story.
Right. Your goals are very different.
on many, 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 many levels. Although I would contend, this is my own vanity, that underscoring the good, in fact, allows people to face the evil more effectively. That otherwise people run away from this stuff. You need something to hold on to. You need a banister that allows you to look into the evil. So it's not a matter of avoiding looking into it. It's a matter of how one looks into it. On the other hand, I feel that if you look only into the evil, you're not even entirely conveying the nature of the evil, because you're not setting up the parameters by which to judge that evil. There are no standards. If in a world that is totally dark, you can't measure how dark it is because you have no light to measure it against.
Yeah. One more question. This film still continues to resonate with modern audiences. Why do you... We've talked a lot about apathy and combating apathy. And I just kind of want to reiterate that point about why the message of the film is still so important to this day and why it's still so important to be vigilant and how we can go about being vigilant.
It's a crucial point because at my age, you know, we tend to see a lot of things as being worse than they were decades ago. And sometimes it's not really true, you know, sometimes it's just a matter of perspective or fatigue or whatever. Mm-hmm. But then again, the magnitude of the evil in the world, it hasn't arisen to the level of a Holocaust, but you sometimes feel it's only because they haven't quite had the means or they, you know, it's so... Oh, vigilance is absolutely crucial, and one does have to have a sense of which we are capable, and we are capable of the evil, and we are certainly capable of the apathy. But we absolutely need to understand that we are capable of the good. And I will add one more thing about the, I guess this was a big discovery for me. I had no idea. I sort of imagined that good people were people who did really difficult things under trying circumstances, were people who agonized over the decision and did the good thing in the morning because they felt they had no choice but to do it, and we're essentially unhappy about doing it. We're doing it, but we're doing it because they had to, and we're not happy doing it. And I came to realize the good people that I've come to know, and I've known a number of people outside of Le Chambon as well, they're all remarkably cheerful, happy. So it's a lesson. It's not only a practical lesson for dealing with the world. I've come to realize it's a very useful... I wish I had some of that. You know, I can't claim that I do, but but I certainly admire it, and I certainly come to recognize that's a major incentive for doing good, is that you may well end up being a happier person.
Yeah. I think that's a good place to stop. And that's the way we frame it, FlixWise, that is. If you have any comments or questions, come find us on our website, FlixWise.com. You can also leave us a comment on Facebook at Facebook.com/FlixWise. You can follow me on Twitter. The handle is @FlixWise. But before you do all of that, please rate us and leave us a comment on iTunes. Coming up next, we're going to have a couple of mini-episodes. We're having an Orson Welles centennial birthday celebration with guest Professor Joseph McBride. And we're also going to have another FlixWise Favorites entry. I don't want to tell you which movie we'll be discussing just yet, but it's going to be a fun one, so stay tuned. Until then, Pierre, thank you so much for agreeing to come on the show.
Thank you very much.
Do you know when listeners will have an opportunity to see the 25th anniversary edition of Weapons of the Spirit?
I don't know yet, but I'm hoping it will be in 2015.
All right, so we will keep you posted. And I hope you'll come on again.
With pleasure.
All right, until then, take care, everyone.
Thank you, Pauline.